Well, my mantra was, I am free and I give hope. So it kind of, I guess, summarized what I was writing down in the goals. But mostly it was kind of a reminder to myself every day that I'm free of stereotypes. I'm free of prejudices. I'm free to screw up and fail. I'm free to just be me. I'm free to do nothing, or I'm free to do whatever I want. Like, it just kind of opened, you know, it just made me in control of what I was going to do that day. And then the second part of my mantra was like, so I am free and I give hope. So the part of that was, yeah, when it's tough and I don't want to do it, I'm kind of lazy if it's for myself. But if there's a thought that any step forward that I take in proving that it's possible to do both science and the arts, and that you can start late and that you can be a female in science or whatever it is, that any step forward that I take possibly gives hope and inspiration to someone else who is probably far more talented and can do it much better than myself and just needs that little example.
A world-class ballet dancer, a PhD in quantum optics, a participant in BBC's astronaut training series, Have You Got What It Takes? Featured in the book Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls and listed in Forbes 30 Under 30, all by the age of 30. These are some of the not-so-small accomplishments in the impossible story of Dr. Merit Moore. Ellie Bourne, a Korean mother and an American father, Merit's upbringing equipped her with the curiosity, problem-solving skills, and unconventional mindset to defy conventions that dictate the impossibility of being world-class in ballet and quantum physics at the same time. In the show, we explore her parents' influence, the empowerment strategies they employed that shaped her view of what's possible, how science and art infused her life from an early age, how a serendipitous encounter in Italy, aged 15, defined her ballet journey, how she developed her love of quantum physics, her father's goal-defining challenge that set her on the course of excellence over perfection, her lack of fearlessness and perception of risk and failure. We also cover how she applies creativity in science and her application of science to improve her ballet, her astronaut training experiences, and a whole lot more, including the challenge we set ourselves to connect Merit with Elon Musk. I hope you enjoy this conversational collision of art and science with Dr. Merit Moore. Welcome, Merit. Actually, welcome Dr. Merit Moore to the Impossible Network.
Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, thank you for the time. What a wonderful, impossible journey you've had. So we'd love to discuss your journey, where you've been, where you're going, and really start at the beginning.
So I was born and raised in Los Angeles, California. So neither of my parents were physicists or dancers. So my father was an entertainment lawyer and my mom was this stay-at-home mom. She had studied classics in college. But I think because I was in Los Angeles, which is, you know, the center of Botox and fake boobs, and, you know, and my dad's an entertainment lawyer, and because we were just surrounded by celebrities, like our house, I mean, next door was Paris Hilton, and on the other side, we were surrounded by it. So my parents took a very active approach towards making sure that I was not going to be like, go down this track of being like
the Paris route.
Yeah.
You could have been Nicole.
That was They're like, you are forbidden. So what they did was perhaps brainwashing and extreme measures. So there was no TV in the house, no Barbies, no dolls, no fashion magazines, no fairy tales, except the fairy tales my father made up.
So hang on a second. Did you say you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger sister.
Younger sister. So you're the oldest, and they made a conscious decision to exclude all this contemporary media from you.
Yeah.
Wow.
We were completely isolated.
Quite visionary.
It was interesting. So, you know, fairy tales at night would be like, so Prince Charming comes and asks you, like, be like, will you marry me? And what do you girls say? And we'd then have to like jump up on the bed and yell out, be like, you have to meet our father first. No way. we were just completely... And interestingly, without me knowing it, I was totally oblivious. But every day my dad would say, girls are smarter than boys, but you got to be nice to them because they don't know it. You know, girls are tougher than boys. We'd wrestle every day. We'd learn how to throw the American football. We were first to know how to ride our bikes and to swim. And like, it was like hard. He brought us up kind of like little boys in the sense that every weekend we'd...
Or, I mean, it's interesting. I was on a workshop yesterday, a sports, the future, looking at sports and purpose, and there were quite a lot of interesting ex-female athletes and a couple mm-hmm. of Olympic champions, actually. Edwin Moses was there, and Benita Fitzgerald Brown from the 84 Olympics. And they were talking about a campaign that was run by Sport England, Like a Girl.
Yeah.
Which is really confronting the perceptions that society has around what a girl is. But it just sounds to me, when you're talking that way, you were brought up like a girl. It wasn't meant. Why should it be deemed to be like a boy?
That's a really good
because
point.
Because that is just reinforcing gender stereotypes.
Yeah, exactly.
So I think it was, like I say, I think a visionary move by your mother and father to do that.
To be, yeah, like a girl, but rough and tough and smart and everything that, you know, we wanted to be. Mm-hmm. So, and then from my mom's side, like, she would stay at home and she was super elegant and feminine and just... charismatic to the extreme, but she was also a double black belt.
At what point in your upbringing did you start to discover your love? Presumably it was a love of science, and in particular physics.
So it began with math. So math was a game that we played at home, like with flashcards, like how quickly could I do, you know, go through multiplication flashcards in a minute. And then if I did better than I did the day before, there was like a, we just ran around the house and like whooped and had these Great Danes that would then bark, and it was just this whole celebratory thing. So math always became this very fun and passionate.
So you're bringing gamification into it.
Yeah.
Yeah, fantastic.
Yeah. And if I did poorly, then there was not, you know, it was just like, oh, well, tomorrow you'll do better, yeah. That kind of thing. And so math always became a really fun pursuit at home. And then at school, I was like, oh, I can, you know, this isn't tough. I can learn it quickly.
And were you outperforming people at school because of your father's influence?
I think my approach towards math, then when I saw math textbooks, I was much more open to it. Mm-hmm. I was like, ooh, let's see if I can, you know, learn this in under a minute. Like that same mentality mm-hmm. of it being a game. And often I would excel. And unfortunately, then the teacher would want the rest of the class to catch up. So they'd give me the textbook to go in the hall. And I'd learn the next chapter and learn it. And then so then I'd place out in the next chapter and I'd go back out in the hall with the textbook. And it was kind of this. But I always loved, regardless, I was still enjoying the math. And at home, I had tons of 3D puzzles and I was always building things. We had tons of arts and crafts around the house. Mm-hmm. So no TV, but lots
so
of
So there was a perfect combination between science and math.
And also, being hands-on.
And yeah, so the creative puzzles. The creative side wasn't left. The creative side was being fostered at the same mm-hmm. time. Do you think that was a conscious effort on the part of your father and mother?
And my mom. Yeah, looking back, I'm like, they fully.
Do you think they had expectations of you, of what they wanted you to do or the direction?
No, they thought I was going to be, my mom thought I was going to be, you know, work at the museum next door and stay at home my whole life because I was quite quiet. Mm-hmm. And I don't think they wanted, I wasn't allowed to do any extracurricular until I was 13 because she didn't want me to have any pressure. She just wanted to offer all of the toys and games that would stimulate my mind that she didn't have growing up. Mm-hmm. So I think both my mom and my dad were kind of neglected as kids. So to counter that, when they had kids, they were like,
interesting.
So they didn't, all of the things that they were doing was in no way to, you know, they didn't envision me being a physicist at all or going to a fancy school. They wanted me to stay at home, but they wanted to give me the experiences that they never had.
Mm. Where did your mother and father grow up?
So my mother, she was born in Korea. And so I know that she had very strict parents that kind of demanded straight A's mm-hmm. and would punish her if she didn't, but would never provide the books, would never provide mm-hmm. the tutoring, wouldn't provide anything that would kind of help her. And so it was constantly a struggle and she was constantly getting punished for it. And on my dad's side, he was the youngest of a lot of kids. And I think that by the time it was him and his twin, the parents at 12, like, mm-hmm. go fend for yourself and just
wow.
leave. So I think both of them kind of then counter, you know, wanted to relive their childhood.
As it usually happens
yeah.
in most people. Okay, so we've got context on that. I did hear you on one interview talk about how that it was your mother that encouraged you to take up ballet because of your tomboy-esque
Well, it was more my posture.
There was
a mix of, I wanted to do karate, and I think she wanted me to do karate, but later on, and she was picky about the coaches because she was a double black belt. So I think when you're an expert, you become a bit more critical about the schooling. And at the same time, I mean, my posture was abysmal. I'd wear tomboy clothes and like slouch around.
You were how old?
12, 13.
Yeah, well, it's that age, isn't it?
Yeah, where you just want to slump around. And so there was kind of a bribe that I'd have to just try dance, but then stop.
Mm-hmm.
She did not want me to continue.
I wonder why she picked ballet rather than some other non-martial arts pursuit. Was there any... Do you think it was because of the posture?
I think it was the posture. At least, I mean, that's what she said. Oh. There could have been some hidden agenda, but I don't know.
So how soon were you bitten by the ballet bug?
It was a mix. So when I first started ballet, I was like, oh, this is tough. Like, I like this. This is, okay. I thought, you know, see me in pink tights and a pink leotard was like the last thing that was going to happen. But it was this Russian teacher who was super harsh.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, there we go. This is good. And then there was after 2 years, I got disillusioned by it because I realized, you know, there's this strive for this perfection and all the girls are supposed to look exactly alike. And this is starting to get real boring. And so I wanted to quit and then did a school year abroad in Italy in a town that I looked up and had no dancing.
Oh.
I was like, we'll do that. But
Bettina, our producer, is Italian.
Oh, there we go. Yeah.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pizza, no?
Viterbo.
Viterbo.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I went...
Oh, place to end up.
It was amazing.
Viterbo. That is really...
Yeah.
How did you end up there?
There's this American school year abroad there.
Oh.
And I was like, okay.
And with other American children.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, that must be...
But you live with an Italian family and... The Italian family I ended up with didn't speak any English. So if you want to eat, you got to learn that Italian real fast.
Which is probably the intent of sending you there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So why did you pick Italy over another country?
I was learning Latin in school.
Mm-hmm.
So Italy was kind of the place you go if you're studying Latin.
All right. So you went to Italy. Did you maintain your ballet during that year?
No, I decided to quit dancing when I got to Italy, but there was a Romanian teacher there who took me under her wing and I would train with her. I would stay at her place and we'd wake up at 6 a.m., go to dance class, and then she would coach me for 2 hours, and then she would go home and make lunch, and then I would continue stretching. Then I'd go back and have lunch, have a quick nap, and then we'd continue training off her radiator.
Okay, this is interesting because I want to get into the subject of serendipity.
Mm-hmm.
And happy accidents that happen. It feels like this is probably
a big one.
But before we do, so you've got no idea what your career is going to be at this point?
There's probably not going to be dance.
So you assumed it wouldn't be dance, but it would be something in the field of science. Did you expect that?
At this point, I'm 15, 16, and I've never taken a physics class, but I have a feeling that I'm going to really like physics.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard vaguely about physics and heard that it has to do with math and putting pieces together and these unknown mysteries that I was super curious about. But I had not taken physics at that point.
Okay. So you met this Romanian teacher. That sounds like a very serendipitous encounter. And just to contextualize this, a lot of listeners might not know the story of serendipity, that Horace Walpole, the English author in the 1700s, had been reading about the three princes of Serendip, an old Persian fable, had gone on a journey and taken the path that was unexpected, and because of this, they encountered experiences they didn't expect. And he coined the term serendipity. And a lot of people believe that serendipity is just luck or chance, but Walpole had this view that it's something you can engineer by the way you live your life and your attitude to life. Mm-hmm. So you'd ended up, because of parents that were willing to send you into an environment that you couldn't speak the language, to experience something new, and this serendipitous experience unfolded of a Romanian ballet teacher.
Mm-hmm. Well, not only let me, well, I had to persuade my parents to let me go.
Oh, okay. Well, it was you, but that was it. I mean, that was a lot. At age 15, having the will and the desire to leave.
It's a funny one because there's so many times. I mean, when I was 15, that was a very definitive point in which I decided I was going to stop dancing. And then this teacher showed up.
That makes it even more pivotal and fascinating, the fact that you'd made a conscious decision to stop, yet...
This amazing teacher shows up when I was 15, and I then, this fall, I went back to train with her. I trained with her, you know.
This fall?
Yeah. So,
oh my goodness,
know,
so
15 years later,
life.
Yeah, I would go in back and train with her twice a year, every year, for over Christmas, over all my holiday times, anytime. And 15 years later, after I've danced in professional ballet companies, I still go back to her
amazing.
To train.
She must be so proud of you.
Well, she won't show it. She will never tell me that. But she has, what she did do for me was just say, look, Merit, the only way you're going to be strong is if you are you, like, unique and different yourself.
Because you like, started late.
Because I started
to most
late.
Ballet dancers who would start around 5 or 6 years old.
Exactly. And I started 13, which is middle age. And so her thing was, look, Merit, you know, if you strive for perfection, you're replaceable. Mm-hmm. But if you stay strong to who you are, then you're irreplaceable. And directors want that. Like the world kind of wants something that they can't replace. So really believe in yourself and be you. And so everything I then did in the training with her in the studio kind of affected my life outside of the studio.
It's an interesting word. I know different people have different perspectives on perfection. But I've heard you talk about your favorite ballet dancer. Called Sylvie
Kiem.
Yeah. Who is more than perfection, it's about excellence. Mm-hmm. And it sounds to me that you strive for excellence on your terms, on using your traits, your personality. And perfection really isn't, well, what is perfection? It's a subjective term. So you've created this identity and this approach to ballet that is very much you, that was encouraged by this vision, again, another visionary person in your life, this Romanian teacher.
Yeah, and I think also realizing that for most of my life, I was someone who was very paralyzed by the desire to be perfect. Mm-hmm. A lot, like all of my childhood. And I mean, I had a lot of freedom growing up as a kid, but you'd put me in a schoolroom and I wanted to blend it. I wanted to be that perfect girl. Like, not that my parents wanted me, but I don't know. There was just something in me that I wanted to do things right. Mm-hmm. I wanted to do it well. And I found that very paralyzing. And so at some point, though, I realized that in myself and I changed kind of what perfection meant for me. So if I went into an audition or something, I then said, Merit, you're doing a good job if you screw up 3 times. Like if you really go for it and you mess up 3 times, we're going to redefine this perfection. And so then it just gave me this freedom to be way more bold and to like, to
screw
up.
Okay, well, this seems like a good segue to bring in the word failure, aligned to that willingness to embrace risk taking and not fear failure. So what was the equation between that and you're striving for perfection, but then that point at which you pivoted and went, I don't need to be perfect.
And I'm going to fail a lot.
But through that failure, you're getting closer to
no, I loved
the perfect
it.
You rather than perfection.
Exactly. And I loved, there was a moment, when I was 18, I went to college and quit dance, but then got pulled back in. And then at 19, I decided, I was like, it's now or never. I'm too old already. I'm 19. I need to get into a company now. Mm-hmm. And so I just went on a ambush. I just did every single audition.
Where were you living at this point?
I was in Boston.
So you'd come from Boston. So wait, how did Italy at 15, 16, from Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. You came back from Italy.
Yeah, came back, did my final senior year in Los Angeles. Did my first physics class. Uh-huh. I was like, I like this. Although the professor, I do remember the professor being like, man, I don't think this is for you. Because I was picking up the concepts quite slowly. Mm-hmm. It just was taking me quite a while to digest them. And I keep going back to office hours and keep asking questions. And he was like, Merit, I'm not sure this is for you. Mm-hmm. But I was like, but I like it. And so I just continued with it. And so then I applied for colleges and decided, okay, this is the end of my dancing. And not, you know, enough people, a lot of people have said, A, I started too late. A lot of people that I respect their opinions of. So we have said, I've started too late. And that once you go to college, it's never possible to then
combine the two.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I understand that people would say that in ballet because it's usually something you associate with complete and utter dedication. But having, you know, I went through university as being an athlete, running for my country, managing to combine the two and having a kid at the same time, which I could not argue is another added distraction. Yeah. But if athletes can do it, why couldn't ballet dancers? Why is there an expectation that ballet dancers have to be that dedicated?
There's also not the structure at universities that they have for athletes. You don't have
The facilities.
We don't have the facilities.
Yeah,
we don't have PT.
For...
We don't get... We're regarded as the arts, so we get no funding. We get no support. We don't get the training. You don't have the teachers there. Like, it's just... You don't have fellow students at the same level. I was super lucky that I came in with a class with six other excellent dancers, which was kind of unheard of. But there hadn't been six other dancers in like a decade, you know, at the level of the dancers who
in
had
Boston.
Come in with me to Harvard when I had entered.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So you came here, then realized that ballet was still on the agenda. You came to Harvard, obviously you'd achieved a lot, you hit your grades and you entered into what field of study at the time?
Physics.
So it was pure physics you were doing?
Yeah, I went straight to physics. And that was daunting because everyone in the class had done the physics Olympiads and were like the best physicists in the country. And I was like, I just did physics last semester.
Whoa,
and so I was kind of slow. But we'll see how this goes.
But a lot of people would have been disheartened or put off by... Certainly in an environment like Harvard with such high achievers, but you weren't. Why not?
Good question. Because it actually never even crossed my mind. I think a lot was the upbringing that I had, that there was no pressure for me to do well. There was a pressure that I'd have to give, you know, hard work and put hard work into it. If they're going to buy me dance classes or put me into school, you know, I need to put in the hard work and be appreciative of what I'm getting. But there wasn't a pressure of me to, you know, to be the best one at all. I was continually praised for if I failed and got back up. So anytime I did poorly, but I got back up and continued working, that's when my parents would be very effusive about how, that they were super proud about that.
Okay. And what about your mentors and who was encouraging you at the university at the time?
At university, I think I still, you know, I was still going back to my mentor in Romania, the ballet mentor. A lot of my mentors have been in dance, have been incredibly strong women in the dance force who have really taken me under their wing. I also had an incredible female mentor, Melissa Franklin, who was the first tenured female professor at Harvard, first female head of the department system. And also, I was surrounded with these incredible peers who were so diverse and unique and had different perspectives. That was very eye-opening.
Okay. Your personality traits that you developed, obviously from an early age because of your father and your mother's upbringing, everything you've said so far, it seems to give me a sense of immense self-discipline, strong belief in yourself, the willingness to take actions, regardless of the risk of failure. Where does goal setting fit into all this? Have you been a goal setter, or have you just followed your gut?
I would say it's a mix. Yeah, when I was 15, before Italy, and at the point that I had quit dance, I was at the point where I just didn't see the point in anything. I just was like, why? A, everyone's saying that I won't make it in dance, so why am I putting all this work into it? And then B, like, and then it made me question why I was putting so much work into academics. I was like, why do I care about this test? And why do I then care about waking up? Like, why do I care about the next? Like, I don't know. I totally lost. I was like, yeah, I lost all motivation. And finally, begrudgingly, went to my dad and was like, yeah, what is the point? Like, why am I doing this? And he gave me a piece of paper and a pen and said, look, write down things that would possibly make you excited to wake up the next day. Dream like super big in the future and write down why it would be super exciting for you but more importantly, like, why this would be helpful for other people.
And what did you write down?
At that point, I think it was like figuring out why it would be helpful for other people that it got me excited. And I was like, at that point I wrote down, like, I want to prove that it's possible to dance, even though I started so incredibly late. And I want to prove that I can do academics and dance. And I want to prove that, and I can do both at a super high level, because right now I've lost all hope. No one's giving me any hope.
And everyone was telling you no.
And everyone's telling me no. And wow. If I can possibly show that it is possible, then maybe other people can have the hope and more of a desire to continue on. Like, you know, I can bring something that I'm lacking at the moment. And that kind of got my butt in gear.
Right. Okay. That's really interesting. So I did physics at school, and I annoyed my physics teacher because I kept questioning about the rules of physics, and I used to question and challenge everything. But one thing, obviously, I understood a lot at that early age was around E equals mc squared and about momentum.
Yeah.
And if we take that equation, you've had momentum from that point onwards.
Mm-hmm.
You wrote these goals down, and that gave you the momentum, the belief to carry on and achieve what you've managed to go on and achieve. Can you talk about, just to help for any of our listeners that aren't like myself, that aren't great with physics, just a little bit of a layman's overview of quantum physics versus the traditional Newtonian?
Yeah, so this is what really got me into physics. And I was like, oh my God, this is so cool, was realizing that there's this whole like environment in, you know, at the very small level, which needs to be isolated if we want to look at it, and where things start to happen in kind of like, we call it mysterious ways because we don't experience it at our level. But there's data, and I've done all these experiments, and you can see it happen where you can have something that's a superposition of light, right? Can be both a wave and a particle, or neither or both, until you measure it. And then it's one or the other, depending how you measure it.
And when you measure it.
I mean, it just made my like mind go bonkers.
And no one understands why the two sides don't correlate, of two sides of physics, the what we experience and what we see and what we can.
Versus like the quantum right? Yeah. Like why can you only experience it at this very small, isolated level? But the thing is that even though it's not at our level, they're making technology with it.
Like, yeah, exactly.
Quantum computers
right. And the chips that are being advanced right now, they're going to completely re-engineer and change the way we experience the world. And we're going to come and ask you about more specific things around things like AI and advances in technology. But when did you get an appreciation, say, right, my focus is going to be on quantum
physics? I took a couple. I mean, I think physics is poorly taught. And so you're first left with to learn pulleys and ramps and all of these very boring topics that
seems like a prosaic and
that you're
more
like
imagination.
There's going to be an app for this, right? Like, or there already is. Or it just felt kind of lame at the moment. But yeah, so it took a couple classes to then be introduced to quantum, and I just remember like browsing through magazines and books, and just like getting a taste of it, even though I wasn't in the class yet. And so that's when I started getting a feel for it. And the more I learned, the more interested I got. And so after my first quantum mechanics class, I then just kind of went up to a professor and was like, hi, can I, like, I'm an undergrad, can I work in your lab? And he was amazing. And he kind of treated me like a grad student, in the sense of, he was like, here's your own project. I mean, it was like Meyer on a fermions. I had to go in this clean room where you get your retina scanned and the doors open, and then
retina. What do you call them?
To get into the clean room, it would take a retina scan and then be like, "Welcome, you have been detected," and the doors would open. And I go in, and so I was like full on using this like high tech equipment as an undergrad, and that's when I got way more excited because I'd pay attention to class, but I found the lectures kind of boring and I didn't see the point. I was like, okay, I'll just memorize it for the test and then forget it.
Mm-hmm.
But when I was in the lab, I was like, oh, so, I actually need to know. Oh, that's why I'm learning harmonic oscillators. Oh, that's why I'm learning about, like, the electron, you know, this and that. Which I didn't, I don't know, I just kind of memorized for the exam previously. And then after I started working in the lab, I was like, oh, there's a point.
So can you explain quantum optics?
So quantum optics is what I did my PhD in, and it was a subset of the atomic and laser physics department at Oxford. And what, well, my research entailed dealing with light at the kind of, we call them photons. Mm-hmm. They're described as particles of light because they come in these packets of energy. And what I can create them. So my setup, I built this setup in which I focused a high powered laser into a crystal, and we'd be able to create pairs of packets mm-hmm. of these photons. And then these photons were kind of used as possibly as like qubits, like quantum bits. Mm-hmm. And we'd use, or you could take two of these photons and interfere them and
create energy.
Yeah, so these photons have energy, and by interfering them, you're able to do stuff like quantum metrology, which is promises to measure things more precisely with these photons than you can without using the, like mm-hmm. without using quantum. Yeah, that was my experiment, which meant, but it's very difficult to have these.
Does that have an impact on technologies people have heard of, like nanotechnology?
Yeah, so I mean, the idea behind quantum optics is like quantum cryptography or quantum computing. It probably won't be the sole driver of a quantum computer, so it'll be combined with superconducting.
So it'll be a key component of the overall ecosystem of quantum computers.
It'll be a key component in the sense of like communication.
Yeah.
Because nothing travels faster than light. So using light to transfer information is kind of quite relevant.
And cool.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that helps me understand a little bit more about quantum optics. So yeah, sure.
Is it more or less like when you're using lasers for 3D, like cutting machines and stuff like that, like you would use something where it creates energy, but it's very precise in the way it cuts it, things like that?
We use high-powered lasers, but by the time we're using these photons, it's like to detect the photons, we use these detectors that go down to minus 273 Celsius. It's like colder than outer space. We go to zero Kelvin because you have to be able to measure just, it's such little energy that we're using. So the initial laser, I've passed my hand through that laser and it's not fun. You kind of burn yourself.
Oh.
But later on, what we're producing are these single photons, which have tiny, tiny amounts of energy. But we're using that to store information.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Okay, so we've got a good sense of quantum computing, to at least as a layperson, to understand a bit of that direction.
I mean, it's always still confusing. Like, quantum will always be confusing too.
I can't remember whose cat it was. The analogy of
Schrodinger's cat.
Yes, Schrodinger's. How do you say it?
Schrodinger.
Schrodinger's cat, which I think is a way of explaining the phenomenon of not knowing one answer or another. That there isn't anything that doesn't seem to be binary. It's not either an on-off or a yes/no. Or
yeah,
is that a fair way of saying it?
Yeah,
conditions can be dependent, like you said, on time, on event, on
how it's measured. It's so bizarre because it's very hard to wrap your head around when it doesn't happen.
It's interesting. I've got a friend that's just been building an application, which is to solve a problem we all have. I think that there's no central place to save things you discover on the web. You've got multiple things like Evernote and you've got Google Docs. And the reason I raise it is yesterday when I was preparing for this, I listened to a wonderful podcast with a guy on quantum physics before Christmas. And I remember I was in the gym, and I remember looking on Wikipedia and seeing this amazing color. It was almost like this rainbow-esque particle that he discovered. And I went, I need to bring this up. And I couldn't remember. Mm-hmm. I couldn't find it. But it was that whole area. And that discussion he was having was getting into the fourth dimension. This whole quantum theory that there might be multiple dimensions.
Yeah, amazing.
Which is, it sort of feels that if you're dealing with something that is non-binary, non-predictable, that the way that the world is made up, that maybe that does, is it fair to assume that that quantum, that what you're describing there as contradictory at times, could mean that there are parallel experiences or universes or time, and it changes our perception of what time and space is?
There's so many like avenues in physics, like in different fields, that like, for instance, I dealt with quantum optics for 6 years, but my research didn't explore parallel universes at all. So yeah, I'm probably not the expert to answer that question, but you know, it just opens up so many questions, and I mean, it's just endless.
Okay. Well, we could sort of probably spend a whole interview discussing this, because I'm fascinated by that whole area. But to get back on track, we've talked about your serendipity. I've heard you talk before about how you apply your understanding and appreciation of physics and movement to movement in your ballet. How has your creativity and your artistic side manifested itself in your scientific life?
How to start this answer? So one kind of, I don't know if to call it a like hypothesis or experiment, but is, so like meditation has become super popular nowadays about like kind of canceling out all the negative thoughts that one has. But I felt that when I dance and when I, or improv, like turn on the music and just improv, you gain a strength in understanding where you get this kind of gut feeling or this inner voice, I want to say, of like what you should do next and where to go. And so a lot of the times I made it like a hashtag, my morning routines, where I would turn on music and just improv, just to kind of strengthen that gut instinct feeling. And so when I'm in the lab, there is no manual to tell me what to do, right? Like, we're at the frontier of science. No one's, like, to get a doctorate, you need to publish something that no one's ever published before and no one's ever seen before. So you're constantly kind of, you know, knowledge helps strengthen your intuition. But at some point, I think a lot of the times, you know, we were kind of stopped, and I was working with a colleague who wanted to start always from the beginning and go through all of the steps to Z. But by the time we got to Z, we would have like made a ton of errors and like screwed up the setup a little bit. So sometimes I was like, no, I think my instinct says we can go from A and then go to M, step M, and then continue on. Like, and there was a moment where it was kind of like a feeling that I just needed to...
This was when you were at Oxford?
Yeah, when I was doing my experiment. And so when everyone was on holiday, I kind of just snuck in the lab and did it the way I felt was right. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, at that level, there is no right or wrong because no one's done it before, but I just kind of did something that felt right. And it was meant 3 weeks literally sleeping at the lab and turning this knob every half hour. But it worked. It did. Yeah.
That's amazing.
And so that was like at the end of my PhD.
Because if you'd been consulting with your tutor or your, I don't know what you call them, tutor or mentor.
Yeah.
They probably would have advised you against something that might not follow the logic.
Yeah, I've been following their advice for the past year or 2 years, and we were kind of at the same spot every time. But who's, you know, it's very hard to know.
So you got that, and that gut feel, that sense. I mean, so much of it, I've heard so many people talk about the gut of being that second brain that we have, that sense of intuition that you tapped into it. So I just wonder how that overlaps with, that gut feel overlaps with curiosity, which is such a sort of a powerful driver of creativity. But is creativity... In it, when you're trying to come up with something, as you've said, that's never been done before, even be at the cutting edge of science, it's creativity that leads to that moment, that great aha, that discovery.
But I feel even after, you know, the PhD and all of this, like I feel out of everything I've learned and trained, like I've gone through a lot of school, right? But I come out and I'm like, I don't feel particularly well equipped in this field of creativity. Like and I'm supposed to also have been this dancer. You know, I'm a dancer and scientist, but now post PhD, I look out for mentors specifically in creativity, like in the way that they think, because I think in school that's kind of smashed out of you. You're supposed to memorize and regurgitate for exams. And unfortunately for ballet, you know, I was, every time I danced, I was doing it in a way that made me feel strong. But at the end of the day, there's kind of a set box of tools that you're supposed to learn. And
but it's one of the, I think it's one of the fundamental problems that we're facing with our education as we move into this, well into this century, and the challenges that are facing us. In a world of artificial intelligence and quantum computing and machine learning, our school system is still languishing, whether it be in Britain, whether it be in Italy or in the US, in the 20th century techniques. And if we're trying to sort of equip people like yourself who have got an immense capability to learn and to do these multiple, take on these multiple challenges that you've done, you need to be given a new methodology for thinking and learning that has creativity and curiosity and communication at the center of it.
And taught how to ask the right question.
But I don't know if you probably don't have a time to read a lot of books, but I don't know if you've read Yuval Noah Harari's latest book, 21 Rules for the 21st Century.
No, I have not.
It's worth a read. If you get a chance on Audible and just race through it, it's really good. And he has a lot about the future structure for education for
Great.
Children.
Yeah, that will be my next.
Yeah, you'll enjoy it.
I live
it.
Off audio books.
Yeah, as do I. Big tick to Audible, be a sponsor. So, yeah, so that creativity. So I think we're all in, I don't think any of us can ever become creativity something that's a lifelong area to develop, to remain sort of curious and creative. So,
but I think I feel like I could have been, out of all that, if I'm looking back, I'm like, that was a lot of school that I just went through. I don't feel as equipped as I feel that I should be, given that I've been, you know, in that environment for so long. And I think that I'm like, actually, I almost think that I would be stronger creatively in a different environment.
I'm going to just jump back. How did you go from Boston to Cambridge to Oxford?
Ah, okay. So there are a couple leaps in between. So I had done 2 years at Harvard and then done a ton of auditions. My parents encouraged me to do auditions because they loved that I would fail and get back up. But then after like the 25th audition, I got into Zurich Ballet. And at that point, they're like, oh no, what do we do now? Like, we kind of have to let her go. And I was kind of like, And so I went then to Zurich Ballet, had a full year there. And at the end, I was ready to go back to school. I was feeling pressure to go back to school. I was feeling injured. Went back to school for a year, then quit dance, then jumped back into dance and danced with Boston Ballet and went back to school, quit dance, and then decided to apply for grad school. And at that point, yeah, there was a decision to stay in the States or to go abroad. And I'm always looking.
Gotta go.
Yeah, I always like adventures. So I was like, let's go to Oxford.
The path less traveled.
Yeah. And I'd been doing condensed matter as an undergrad. And the professor I had applied for was in quantum optics. So it was a different field, different country, different system. I don't know, all the difference that I could list. I was like, I like this.
Ticked all the boxes. Okay. So you've got your PhD now. You're back in Boston. You're still dancing. What's next?
I know. What a mystery. So I will be dancing with Norwegian National Ballet, a very classical Labaidere with the legendary Makarova. And, well, she'll be setting the piece. And I'll be there a lot, like April to October. Before that, I've got a residency. Harvard has a new arts lab, which is super exciting. And this is going to be research. And, you know, I like, there's a lot to still figure out. And this is when I'm like, start banging my head on the table, being like, man, hey, come on, be creative, be creative. But I think the idea is, or what I'm going to be focusing on is it possible to do physics research in an arts facility?
That's really interesting.
And, well, because right now I think everything that I see that combines art and science, like I think it's good and I think it sometimes communicates ideas better, but I'm not sure it enhances either field particularly. Like I would love to see if I could, you know, is it possible to do physics research? Arts Institute.
When you say physics research, are you talking quantum research or?
Yeah, possibly quantum. I'm also looking into, you know, looking into space. You know, are there questions up there that we can answer down here? Yeah, like there. I mean, one of the examples I kind of list is like Interstellar, where they brought real scientists on board and gave them the facilities and to use this high-tech equipment.
You're talking the film.
The film to, like, you know, create these images of the black hole. And they insisted that they be able to do real science, like real physics, and not just the something that would image it, but like use the tools for this film to create something that was very factual. Mm-hmm. And they were able to publish papers afterwards and discover new things that they would never have been able to do in their own science labs.
There's a couple of directions you could take this in, because I know you've done experimental work in VR, but I find that it's not something that gets me that excited. Mm-hmm. I don't think it can really push the potential of where you're thinking of going with this. I know you've trained as an astronaut, which is a different conversation altogether, and we will come back to it. But it does make me, I do want to ask you a question about Elon Musk. But Elon Musk is, besides all his other incredible endeavors, the one I find the most interesting is Neuralink. And I don't know if you've encountered what he's doing there. So he's starting to build. So Musk, for anyone that doesn't really know Elon Musk's broader agenda, is everything he does is to address the existential threat to humanity. Mm-hmm. So cars, driverless cars, fuel cells, the boring hole company to do holes to help do transport to reduce effect on the environment and therefore the risk of the existential crisis that we face as a planet. The ability to solve a problem for if we are in crisis mode to escape the planet to find another place is SpaceX. And Neuralink is his attempt to develop machine brain interfaces that will be, in his view, the right way to solve and the only way to address the unrelenting march of AI, that it can't just be machines, it has to be a human machine. It's probably our only way of being able to sort of solve it if we come together. I would have thought that area of what he's doing in Neuralink, and if you just read it, I can send you a really interesting article about it. But anyway, I'll send it to you. But if you can look into Neuralink, because I would have thought that area of physics, because it will need quantum solutions, I suspect, to be able to build that machine-brain interface that he's trying to do. Mm. And he's bringing together some of the smartest people on the planet to do it.
Amazing.
I think you and Elon need to get together.
That'd be amazing.
So
I'm on board.
That's not in the real sense, get together.
Well, yeah, I mean, I
would not approve that.
Yeah, okay.
I don't approve.
Okay, I didn't say hook up. I just said...
Girlfriend.
If it was in Scotland, I would be saying...
Oh, they broke up. Oh,
I'll look up.
Reporter.
Is that someone? You?
A Latin American reporter.
Oh.
Well, okay. Anyway, our producer and our creative director here on the side are having a chat about Elon Musk. But to get back to the point, I do think, Merritt, you and Elon's Neuralink team need to start to have a conversation, because I think that could take you in a very interesting direction to address what you're saying, which will take immense amount of creativity, immense amount of understanding and imagination and capability to understand how quantum optics or mechanics will be able to address this problem. Now, I might be completely wrong and they might be not doing any of this, but I do think, it might be a serendipitous moment where you find your answer to that question of creativity. So, we're not quite sure what you're doing next, but we're going to try and help you along the way with a bit of our creativity and serendipity. After all, it is the Impossible Network. And let's go back to you taking on this additional, besides being a ballet dancer, besides being at Oxford, you decide, I'm going to apply to BBC documentary series to be an astronaut. It's not something just do as a sort of a little, like, drunken challenge at a party. You actually did this.
Yeah. Well, I kind of applied as a, you know, at a party. Like, someone like at a party had told me that BBC was looking for applicants. I was at the Christmas dinner. And so I like to apply just then. And it was the incredibly life-changing experience, I would say, on multiple levels. A, it raised the bar for myself immensely, because what's required from an astronaut is over and beyond what's been required from me as a physicist or a ballet dancer.
Yeah.
But it also kind of tapped into a lot of the, I felt like my training as a dancer and physicist, I was like, this is actually quite helpful. You know, while we're getting thrown into helicopters to hover for the first time and dunked underwater and drowned and having to take our own blood. And it just, I don't know, it opened my eyes completely.
And you must have been around other exceptional people. And also, I think it was Chris Hadfield.
Yeah.
Yeah, who's an amazing character in his own right.
Yeah, has been commander of the International Space Station and just, I mean, superhero.
So you went through that program. It was now, a year and a half ago that I think it aired?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. What was the outcome of it?
So outcome was I made it halfway through. There were 12 candidates. And the thing that I failed most at was...
Physics.
No, it was anything kind of video, like that you needed video game skills.
Oh.
So when my parents...
You better be phoned your father and said, Dad!
Yeah.
Dad.
No, I really did. I was like, so when my parents banned the TV from the house, they also banned video games. And unfortunately, to be an astronaut, that's when you're docking the Soyuz to the International Space Station, there's 6 rotations and you need to know how to control with your fingers and control an object from a screen. Or when you're manipulating the Mars rover and there's a 6-minute delay, you need to know how to navigate like a control, or even the helicopter, kids that were, you know, video game were really good as kids.
Scripted
had,
behavior.
were like so good. Yeah. So that was what I was terrible at. Oh. And that kind of docking the Soyuz into the International Space Station was not my...
So I do hope that in your apartment, I've got the latest Xbox and PlayStation. I'm sorry.
I know. I started.
Mr. Moore, can we have a chat?
I know. I was just so sad. But I started piloting lessons. Mm-hmm. And continuing that training. Mm-hmm. So we'll see. We'll see if I can merge this all serendipitously.
You've got to keep it on the agenda. I see astronaut badges somewhere down the line for
Elon Musk, right? Like,
well, there you go. I mean, if Elon might be saying to you, hey, hang on a second, Merritt, I don't need your brains on Neuralink, but I do need your help with this gnarly little problem we've got getting to Mars faster.
Or Yusaku, who's going to be the first traveler in SpaceX, is going to bring 8 artists with him.
Yeah.
And so I'm not sure how to... I was like, maybe I should tweet them. And just
that'd be great. Ballet in space.
Ballerina dork really wants to go.
Oh, yeah, you've got to do that. We've got to start
ballerina's
hashtag.
Ballerina's an artist.
Let's get that hashtag together.
Let's get this going.
Okay. Any listeners, please send in your thoughts to what the hashtag should be to get Merritt onto that space program. Okay? There'll be some nice... prize for you in New York or Boston that we'll do, buy you dinner or something.
That's a good story.
Okay, so Elon Musk, we've covered off. We've talked about you might be going to Mars. You're certainly going to be helping with Neuralink and doing something that is going to solve some problem that the world has at the moment that we don't know the answer for, because that's clearly that you have that creativity, curiosity, although you don't believe you do, but I have a genuine belief that everyone does have that.
Yeah, I agree, everyone has it. I think it's just... kind of training it. I think it's like a muscle.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. But it's also having the confidence, and it's that ability to... it's maybe a challenge of time, but I do believe that you have to put yourself into places you wouldn't otherwise find yourself. So whether it is areas of discomfort or going to galleries, museums, reading different books, things that you wouldn't encounter, speaking to people, random people that come from different generations that might tell you something that you'd never thought of before. It's that type of thing that mixes up that leads to it. It's not living predictable lives.
Yeah.
So you were featured in a book called Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, which is amazing.
We're
going to come and ask you about that. That's an amazing story. Because I've heard you mention it before, what did they ask you? What did they...
They had reached out via email and I was busy writing my thesis. So I think I just replied and said... They asked if they could feature me, and I was like... I had no idea who they were or what. And I was like, yeah, I think I'm probably like, yes. And then went back to my thesis and later found out what that actually meant and was like, oh my goodness. Oh my, yeah. And met the authors who are just a force of nature and incredibly inspiring.
And so I think we've got a book request for you at the end, but we might add that one because I think it's obviously a book that people should read, and certainly my little nieces and probably my daughter herself will get it as a present for the next couple of months. I'm conscious of time. I want to jump in and do some quickfire questions. What principles do you stand by?
Moral principle?
Something you live your life by, something you wouldn't, that keeps you on that the right path, something that would be a compromise to your character if you didn't follow it.
I have the belief that nothing's impossible. Possible just takes time. And so whatever hard work you put in, you know, will pay off in the end. In terms of principles, I think just this, my simple one is like sister comes first and then, you know, my other pursuits. And yeah.
What does sister do?
Sister is in grad school. She's at Georgetown. Yeah. And she's my rock and best friend. And we've just... always been very close.
And don't tell me that she's a karate major in their spare time.
she was a competitive diver, but she stole all of the funky cool jeans, so she does hip-hop instead of ballet.
You can dance to her hip-hop.
We do onesie dances together. She choreographs dances.
Can we see dances. Some more of that on Instagram, please? Okay, we've got your principles. What hard choices have you had to make that might have been tough at the time but turned out to be the right decision?
Good question. Tough
Hard choices. Well, the reason we asked this question, there's, I don't know if you've come across Jerzy Gregory, who is an amazing Polish weightlifter, and he has a line he says, which is, hard choices, easy life. Easy choices, hard life.
I think it's hard, the way it's asked, like hard choices, because I think a lot of my decisions, I can't do it any other way. So like when I graduated with my PhD last year, it was kind of... you know, starting from zero, and you get a lot of pressure to go straight into finance or a conventional job. And I was kind of determined. I was like, I'd rather starve to death than like give up this physics and
good on you.
This dance.
And also, let's face it, you're 30. So a lot of the people who are asking this are a little bit older than that. So maybe you've got some other hard choices, but I think you just answered it with that answer in terms
and
of
I've
not going into a mainstream career.
I've had to face hard scenarios, but I think they're kind of dealt to me, and I didn't really have a choice. So you kind of deal with it best you can.
Okay. I like that. Where do you go, or what do you do to discover new ideas or when you need space to think?
I love not looking at my phone and just, so commuting, oddly, like airports, I find incredibly therapeutic and my place to kind of as my restart button, because I find that, you know, as strong as I'd like to be, no matter, you know, I'm in different environments, whether it be LA back home or London, you know, I get, there are certain things that push and pull me a certain way and I feel different pressures and kind of societal, you know, what's expected of me, as strong as I try to stay. But whenever I go to an airport, I feel quite free of that. Like, A, I'm entering an environment where no one knows me. Cultures are all mixed up. Like, there's no right or wrong, really. And I can just kind of start from scratch. And often I take a pen and paper and I write down.
Do you journal?
I do journal. I mean, probably not as well as I should. And it tends to, sometimes it's this, an email draft that then gets pushed down or...
I interviewed recently Ryder Carroll, who's an ADD sufferer and ended up being a digital designer, a product designer. And he's created this book called The Bullet Journal because he had to solve his own ADD problems. And he did it through creating a methodology for journaling and capturing his thoughts and managing his attention.
Wow.
And it's brilliant. So if you get a chance to... We'll send you a copy of the Bullet Journal. It's a great book to read because it's his methodology of managing things and it's very structured. I've started and I do find it quite useful.
But I felt like I probably would have been diagnosed with ADD and somehow, but having to juggle the dance and the physics was what kept me focused.
Yeah.
And what was like, I definitely would not have been able to finish the physics PhD without dance.
That's really interesting.
And would not have, I think, stuck through dance without having physics, because I could juggle back and forth in a way that would kind of keep my attention kind of going. But I would need to be distracted. And so I'd distract it with the other thing and then go back and forth.
Okay.
Yeah.
You talked about, obviously, your most inspiring, your teacher, your Romanian, and also the woman, the dancer called Sylvie Guillaume. Are there any other influencers or inspirations you have in the physical realm? In the physics or scientific field?
I would say he's kind of like the stereotype Einstein, but it's mostly because he came up with a lot of his incredible ideas with imagination and creativity first.
Any women?
In physics? Well, I had my incredible mentor, Melissa Franklin.
That, yeah. The question I should have asked you earlier was really a question around diversity, Me Too, and everything that's happening. Mm-hmm. We will come back and just ask you that if you've got time at the end. This is a crazy question to ask you. How do you keep up with technology? But although you are a quantum physicist, you still have to deal with the day-to-day realities of the latest technological advances outside of your specific area field. And how do you keep up?
Sorry, in the lab or like just my phone?
No, just personally. And
I'm the worst. I always have the oldest version of everything. And I don't know, emails kick my butt every day.
And how do you keep up with the latest advances in, because it must be such a rapidly developing field, quantum physics.
It's rapid and also slow.
Mm-hmm.
I think there are a lot of hurdles that take quite a long time to get over. And I think it's now going to be much faster now that a lot of the research is done through private sector.
Mm-hmm.
I think in academic setting, it's really slowed down because the brilliant postdocs have to spend time writing the grants to get the money to then, you know, and you have to go through these purchase forms, which take forever to get approved. And just research in the academic level takes quite a while. Yeah, it's you know, fast and slow at the same time.
Okay. I think you've answered this question as well, but I'm going to ask you again, because we always ask our guests the impossible question. It's what your advice would be to someone 20 years younger than you, but maybe 10 years younger than you, who may have a dream, a goal, a grand ambition, but is being told, like you were told, you can't do that. It's not possible.
Yeah, my go-to, which is nothing's impossible. It just takes time. And also that for them to know that their potential is far more than what they can possibly imagine and what anyone else can possibly imagine. That's been my go-to. And the other thing is kind of making a mantra for themselves that keeps of what, you know, what excites them and pushes them in times when it's sort of tough and entails a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
When you talked about your goals, do you think those goals were your mantra? That you, when you set yourself, the thing your dad made you sit down and write?
Yeah, well, he encouraged me to write. And my mantra then, well, my mantra was, I am free and I give hope. So it kind of, I guess, summarized what I was writing down in the goals. But mostly it was kind of a reminder to myself every day that I'm free of stereotypes. I'm free of prejudices. I'm free to screw up and fail. I'm free to just be me. I'm free to do nothing, or I'm free to do whatever I want. Like, it just kind of opened, you know, it just made me in control of what I was going to do that day. And then the second part of my mantra was like, so I am free and I give hope. So the part of that was, yeah, when it's tough and I don't want to do it, I'm kind of lazy if it's for myself. But if there's a thought that any step forward that I take in proving that it's possible to do both science and the arts, and that you can start late and that you can be a female in science or whatever it is, that any step forward that I take possibly gives hope and inspiration to someone else who is probably far more talented and can do it much better than myself and just needs that little example. And so that's kind of spurs me forward for, you know, the difficult hours of being in the lab and late at night, you know, in the studio.
Before we ask the final two questions, one's about a book and the other one's about who we should interview next, I do want to go back and ask the two questions I skipped. The one is about diversity and inclusion, particularly in the sciences. And mm-hmm. I mean, I know there's a lot being happening in ballet circles with the director of the New York Ballet that we don't need to spend time on. I think it's been well documented and it's an issue in that side of in the arts, and mm-hmm. as we well know. But there is a lack, a dreadful lack of inclusion of women in the sciences. Mm-hmm. So two things there. Is it being addressed? And how do you think that there is an issue for the Me Too movement in the sciences?
At least there are conversations going on. I think the change is very slow in happening. I think the ratio has been the same for the past 40 years. And unfortunately, the debate starts happening up at universities. Mm. And at that point, I'm kind of like...
Too late.
Yeah, like the kid, like people have already made up their minds what they like, what they want to do or what they can't do. And so you'll see these fellowships for like women who have just graduated to like continue on. And I'm like, look, I'm committed to the... I'm committed to the physics. Like, mm. the problem starts at age three. Like, and I believe that, you know, it happens at age three with the toys and the bombardment and the commercials and what, you know, girls are.
Yeah.
You know, what's kind of subconsciously happening.
Presumably, it's changing. I mean, I'm very familiar with the Girls at Code movement. There's obviously more women going into education. Even if you look at the stats in the UK, there are more girls achieving high level grades in education, particularly in the sciences. I think there's obviously, at an educational policy standpoint, changes still need to happen. But there seems to be movement in the right direction.
I think there's movement in the right direction. But I think it's easy to say that there's movement in the right direction if you're just looking at on that level. Mm-hmm. I think, you know, it's easy to just look at those stats, but then to forget, yeah, a girl wakes up and the minute we go outside, we're treated differently if we have our hair up or if, you know, we have makeup on or if we don't, or if, you know, if we go for a lunchbox that has a dinosaur on it, it's labeled as a boy's lunchbox. And then we're kind of questioning whether or not we're allowed to like it, even though probably half the dinosaurs were female as well. You know, like, it's just like just all constantly being, mm-hmm. and it's just
the
on
gender
the
gender stereotypes that we're bombarded
with. Yeah, like from commercials to like just everywhere.
It's crazy. So it goes really deep.
It goes
even where we think there are advances happening, we're still some way off.
Yeah. And I used to think there was a whole debate at Oxford about whether or not they should change the history, right? And there are these old photos of, you know, a ton of old white men all around the campus. And I don't know, that I used to think, I was like, it's history. I don't like, yeah, I'm fine with it. Mm-hmm. But there was one event I got invited to speak to, and I'd never actually been part of the Women in Physics Club, because in my head I was like, well, maybe it just highlights the fact that there is a difference between men and women. But I was invited to speak to these little girls, and I said yes, and I was at lunch with them, and we were in the dining hall, and they're all 11, and they were looking up at the portraits, and I don't know, one found one female, and they're like, oh, there's a female, there's a girl, there's a woman. And the girl next to her was like, Duncan, it's just the wife of someone, you know? And at that point I was like, you know, like what they absorb at such a young age, you know, it's hard to tell them, being like, that was the past, we've now proceeded to the future. And so at that point it kind of changed my mentality, and I then just joined the Women in Physics Club, and then
It's funny, I was either hearing someone interviewed, I think it was around the time of the release of Black Panther, and how he was brought up by his mother as a single parent. She used to take him only to see black movies. And there were obviously a certain limited amount, because she didn't want him to be given the Hollywood and cultural stereotypes. Mm-hmm. Therefore, he grew up not thinking about people not being in cinema being black, because that's all he saw.
Yeah.
And it's a brilliant way of managing it. Same way. I mean, it's exactly the same way. It's a, when you said that about your father, I immediately thought of that.
Yeah.
And it's the same thing. We have to engineer change, even if it, I don't think it's changing history. I think it's just how the
we
cues you give people.
Perception. Initial perception.
Yeah. You're not in denial of history. You can still talk about it and say, look, this happened. But don't ram it down people's... So when they're in this neuroplasticity phase where they're sort of absorbing yeah. stuff, that they are given this sense, reinforced with the day-to-day gender stereotypes, that you're not good enough or you, it's not for you.
You just have so, them questioning, yeah. I think, at a young age. Yeah, there are a lot
there's
of cases
a lot of work
at
to
kindergarten.
Do.
Yeah.
Maybe we'll do a follow-up on this one. The other question I was going to ask, if you were given, handed the keys to the White House or the mayor's office even, what would you start to do or what key changes would you make to improve the future opportunities of youth in this country?
Definitely with education.
Hmm. Maybe you answered it around those gender stereotypes.
Yeah, if I had one thing to change, I'm not sure I'd change this. But on a smaller basis, I think at least for physics, I would introduce the quantum mechanics and special relativity and galaxies in the universe, all of it, like the bizarre black holes and this and that, before the ramps and the pulleys.
There you go.
And save
that
for the end. Yeah, but I mean,
stimulate the imagination first.
Yeah, but in terms of like White House, I'd be like, maybe Trump can we can, can go.
No, but you'd be given the keys. He wouldn't be there.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd be President
like
Moore.
You out.
Okay, right, down to the final two. So we like to offer a book to our listeners who submit the best comments in the comment section. What book would you like us to give? Besides the Rebel book that you appear in.
The most recent book I just read was The Art of Learning by Josh Waitzkin. And it was, he was this world-class chess champion and then martial artist. And it kind of talks about the... not just to get to the top 5%, but between, you know, his 5% and 1%. Mm. And that was fascinating. And
yeah, he's a fascinating character.
It's yeah.
Totally inspiring to listen to an interview mm-hmm. with him.
Because I find in all the pursuits, like strengthening the mind. And I mean, I used to read tons of like the sports psychology books and self-help books because I had started dance late physically. And so, you know, I just thought, well, at least I'll come at it with like mentally as strong as I can.
Mm-hmm. Final question. Who should we interview next?
Ooh, let's see, interview Elon Musk and then see if...
Right, okay. Right, listen here. Listen here, Dr. Moore. Just you settle down. If we're only just started the Impossible Network, it would be almost impossible to get to Elon Musk at the moment. Maybe it's a challenge for me then, right? Besides Elon Musk... and Josh Waitzkin, who should we interview next?
Ooh, anyone
you think that would be a good guest on the Impossible Network? Someone that's done something that you think is pretty damn good. Someone that has achieved their possible when others, that embraces the same principles you do.
Well, someone's creativity who really inspires me is Thomas Heatherwick. And
oh, yeah. Oh, my goodness. Yeah.
Yeah. Who... I was, you know, fortunate enough to have some conversations with who was like able to, in the way that he asks questions, like that's when I'm like,
okay,
oh, okay. My creativity is nowhere. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah, it's someone like that who inspires.
Well,
like,
if you're connected to him, I will at some point, it won't be next because we've got other people to interview.
Yeah.
If you're up for it to do a little intro, once you're live, you say, hey, I've been interviewed on the Impossible Network. And I know he's in New York and London, so sitting down with him would be wonderful.
Yeah.
So I'll just summarize. I think you have gone beyond what I expected you to be as a guest on the Impossible Network. Absolutely okay. Brilliant. I think for me, probably the most powerful takeaway from this interview is your mantra of being free and giving hope. Because I think anyone that listens to this interview with you, that reads about you, that follows you on Instagram, that discovers you in the book that you've been featured in, either the new one that's you put on Instagram, which is
Be Bold. Yeah. Oh, Bold
or,
Women.
Bold Women Guide. Bold Women or the Rebel
Girls.
Yeah.
Yeah, Volume 2.
Volume 2. Will be inspired and given hope, both in their ability to achieve whatever they desire or are expected to deliver by their peers, their family. And you also give hope that society is changing. You're a beacon of change, that someone that's driving change in society, that is setting down the benchmark to other women and for men to step up, and policymakers to understand that change can only happen when individuals drive themselves, but also in parallel, that people who are in positions of responsibility and power can do what they need to do, that they know needs to be done, to address the inequities in society, particularly the gender inequity, because society needs it and society will benefit. So I applaud you for what you've done. I'm excited as to what's in store in the future, because I think whether we do get this Mr. Musk and Miss Moore connection, could be a good movie there, a good documentary maybe down the road. Documentary producer sitting beside me. I think you are going to be play some pivotal part in some very positive changes in society. So I'm really looking forward to the next 20 years of your journey.
Thank you so much.
So thank you very much for being on the Impossible Network.
Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, folks, that's it for this week. If you like the show, please subscribe and ideally give us a 5-star rating and a review, because it helps more people discover us. Just go to iTunes, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Podcasts, or wherever you listen to subscribe and rate. For now, stay curious, be creative, and be open to serendipity. See you next time.